As you can see, we're going to start a new series here on the letter to the Hebrews. So turn with me to the book of Hebrews. And since we've spent some time in the book of James, just go left a little bit because it's just the book before the book of James. And then we're going to, at the end, as I always do, and if you're new to the class, we always kind of cover some of the material that the church encourages us to do, and we'll be going through Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, this fall. Then we add something that would be of interest, and last week we talked about the Harbinger, and we talked about the Shemitah. Matter of fact, I had a few people saying, are you going to talk about that? Well, we actually did last week. You can go to PrestonWoodExamine.org. I'll say some more about that. But E.J. Janik suggested maybe we would get today into the subject of, well, are there any kind of trends in the decline of a nation? So as you can see in the handout, we will get to that as well. Even though he asked for it, he's not here today, so he'll have to listen to it. But nevertheless, that was his suggestion, and so we will cover that as well. As you get to the book of Hebrews, of course, you will see that we will constantly refer to the fact that it is the writer of the Hebrews, because we are not exactly sure who wrote it. It is anonymous. And there have been all sorts of speculations about who has written the book of Hebrews. Some, especially in the Eastern Church, have always held that it was Paul that wrote that. The argument is Paul wouldn't have written 13 epistles. He would have written at least one more, possibly. But the language doesn't really match the other letters by Paul. So that's why many people have suggested that maybe the candidate is Luke. Because the Greek phrases in the book and the letter to the Hebrews match some of the writings of Luke. Now, if you would like to really understand this, a good friend of ours, David Allen, has written a 400-page book, scholarly book, on the subject. I'm going to spare you the basic content of it. But he argues not only that Luke is the author of this letter to the Hebrews, but based upon this also makes a very powerful, I think very compelling argument that he is the unnamed disciple on the road to Emmaus. And that what we're reading in the letter to the Hebrews are some of the things that Jesus actually communicated to the disciples after his resurrection. Remember, there's a time between the resurrection of Jesus and his ascension. I don't know about you, but I always kind of wonder, what did they talk about? We have a little bit of that in the Gospel of John. But you say, what else did Jesus communicate to the disciples? And I think the argument that David Allen makes here is that what we're actually going to be reading is what Jesus communicated to them. And one of those people listening to that was Luke. And so in a sense, we're actually getting a chance to fill in a little bit of the gap that maybe we have. Well, if that's new to you, well, that's pretty good. If you disagree, well, you can take on this 400-page scholarly book if you want. But I thought it was really intriguing, even before we get into the book itself, to recognize that we are actually going to be delving into some of the teaching of Jesus in terms of what he passed on to the disciples. Breaks down pretty easily, and that's how we will do it. Hebrews 1, verses 1 to 9. And really, the theme of this is Jesus is better. Jesus, first of all, we'll see, is better than the prophets and the angels, and then Jesus is better than the creation and all things. But turn with me, if you would, to Hebrews chapter 1, and we'll begin there. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. Verse 3, he is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. Verse 5, for to which of the angels did God say, you are my son, today I've begotten you? Or again, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. And again, when he brings the firstborn into the world and says, let all God's angels worship him. Of the angels, he says, he makes the angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire. But this of the son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. And so here we have an argument being made by the writer to Hebrews, as he is writing to those who were Jews who had now become Christians, that Jesus is superior to all things. And the first thing we see here is, of course, he is better than the prophets. He opens up with a greeting, but it's really not much of one. You know, even we saw the greeting this morning. Pastor Graham talks about the fact that James could have said, you know, and now writing to you as the brother of Jesus, as the leader of the Jerusalem church. No, you see a humility there. You see even more humility here because he just immediately just jumps in. The greeting is just long ago and right into it. And the point he makes is that Jesus is superior to the prophets. How so? Well, arguing that there was certainly a great respect. Those who are reading this are Jews who become Christians, most likely, and they certainly would have had great respect for the prophets. So if the prophets were here, what the writer to Hebrews is saying is Jesus is even more superior than that. How is he better than the prophets? Well, because in previous times, God used the prophets to reveal a specific message. If you look at the prophets that we've looked at in the class here, whether it's Isaiah, whether it's Ezekiel, whether it's Jeremiah, whether it's the minor or major prophets, oftentimes they had just a partial revelation of God. It is quite possible that some of the prophecies that they were to write down, they did not completely understand. Isaiah, perhaps, did he really understand, as we talked about last week in Isaiah 9, all of what that would mean in terms of the Messiah? So they had a partial revelation and maybe at best a partial understanding of what they were actually revealing. But here, the argument that the writer to Hebrews is making is that Jesus is a full revelation. And more than that, he also says that he is more than that, is also a full representation, or the ESV says full imprint of God as well. So whereas before they had glimmers of revelation and a little bit of a perspective of a future Messiah, a Son of God that would come, now we have the full representation and we have the full revelation. So I think that is a really powerful argument. Today we might, as Christians, go, okay, I kind of understand that. But this must have been very dramatic for somebody who was always holding the prophets in such high esteem. And here, of course, this is what the writer is doing. Then he goes on in verse 2 to talk about then the creation, because he is the heir of all things, and then God actually works through Jesus for the creation. When I speak in this room on Wednesday the 23rd, one of the things I want to talk about to set up the various material that we will be studying for a number of weeks with the Institute for Creation Research is really making the case for why we believe in creation. And one part of that is we believe in creation because, first of all, Jesus believed that God created. There's some who say, well, I'm not so sure about an Adam and Eve. Well, Jesus believed in an Adam and Eve. I'm not so sure about a Noah. Jesus believed in a Noah. But more importantly, Jesus not only believed in creation, Jesus was part of that creation. He was, in a sense, that intermediary, which we'll talk about in just a minute. But notice, interestingly enough, how this is tied in verse 2 to the last days. And the idea is that God was speaking through the prophets, but now in these last days. Are we in the last days? Everybody shake their head. Yes, of course we are. By definition, we're in the last days. He has spoken now through his Son. So whereas before, some of the revelation was shrouded in the Old Testament, now we have the full representation in the person of Jesus. And it says that he was the heir of all things. For those of you that have something to take notes with, you might put down Hebrews 2, verse 8. Next to that, because in the handout, we will probably get into that next week when we talk about how that connects up. It is interesting right now that we're talking about Jesus as creator, Jesus as part of that creation, and they'll be doing the Institute for Creation Research series here. So it's a really wonderful hand and glove. But here we see in another key verse is Colossians 1, verse 16. Here it talks about Jesus basically holds everything together. That's pretty important. Because everything seems to be coming apart right now, both socially and even biologically and in the culture and the world and in the universe. I mean, entropy is increasing, the world is running downhill, but Jesus is holding that together. And so he creates both space and time. And so there's some very significant points. We'll get into more of that next week when we talk about Hebrews 2 and that connection, I believe, which is very strong to Colossians 1, verse 16. Let's keep it moving. In verse 3 here now, we see a little bit of a change from the creation now to the Father. And here, the relationship of Jesus to the Father. First of all, Jesus is the radiance of God's glory. That is, when you see Jesus, you see a good picture of who God the Father is. Not completely because of the incarnation, but it gives you a radiance of God's glory. It reflects God's spotless purity. And then it says that he is an exact imprint, or some of your translations might say an exact representation. It's always good to have a good imprint. You know, if you are in the printing business, you know that if you don't have a good print, you go back and do it again. And so here is this idea of an imprint, an exact representation. He had the divine substance of the Father. And this, again, is just, I think, a very powerful argument for the deity of Jesus Christ. I know some of you witnessed individuals that deny that Jesus is God. And as we went through the Gospel of John, there were lots of verses we picked up here. But here's one right used as well, that he is the exact imprint of God the Father. Very powerful argument again for the deity of Jesus Christ. Then goes on to say that not only that was he responsible in the creation, but I've already alluded to that, it says he sustains the world. The implication is if Jesus did not hold the world together, it would all completely fly apart. And so that is something, and it also is just a reminder that Jesus is in charge. And then finally, it goes on to talk about that Jesus provided for the purification of our sins, the supreme grace that we enjoy here as well. And then after all of that, Jesus ascended to the throne. He's now in a place of honor at the right hand of God. If you're taking some notes, just put down, he is Lord. He's at the right hand of God. He's in control. And what a great message after we've just heard today about the trials that we will face as believers and how we still, in the midst of sometimes not seeing God in control, can still at least rest on the promises here that indeed he is in control. Then we see that the writer of Hebrews has already compared Jesus to all sorts of things, the prophets, his relationship to the Father, but now he compares Jesus to the angels, and we now begin to see seven different quotes from the Old Testament. One of the reasons I think some people have rejected the idea that Luke was maybe the author of Hebrews is because it's obviously written by a person who had a real familiarity, a very significant familiarity with the Old Testament. Now, it is certainly possible that some people that have said Luke was a Gentile, that maybe he was Jewish. Or it's also possible that as he went through this kind of 40-day cram course when Jesus is on earth between his resurrection and ascension, he got into the scriptures and more than he had. But for whatever reason, this particular writer, whoever it may be, and I still think Luke makes a good sense, really understands how the Old Testament relates to the New Testament. Because now he compares Jesus to the angels, and he first of all says that Jesus is better than the angels because of his title. He's the Son of God. The angels are not. And so again, we see here that we read the first of these seven Old Testament quotations, and we see this one here immediately coming from Psalm 2, verse 7. If you want to take some notes, you can maybe in your space there put down where these come from. And Psalm 2, verse 7, you are my son, today I have begotten you. Well, only God refers to one individual as his son, and that is Jesus. He does not refer to the angels as his son. So first of all, he is superior because of his title. Then the second one, interestingly enough, also gets into this idea that I will be to him a father and he will be to me a son. This one comes from 2 Samuel 7, verse 14, and it refers to David. But later on, the prophets actually began to look for someone who would be in the lineage to David, who would be the complete fulfillment of that. And that you see in Micah 5, 2, and that, of course, is who? Well, that's Jesus. We also see that the New Testament writers also proclaim that Jesus was a descendant of David and fulfilled this verse. And I just put down one passage which illustrates that. Paul says that, for example, in Romans 1, verse 3. And so again, we see that Jesus is superior because of his title. Jesus is superior because he's the fulfillment of that prophecy, if you will, of David and the coming Messiah. Then we see also Jesus is superior to the angels because what? The angels worshiped him. That one's pretty simple because we see that let all the angels worship him. You say, well, when did the angels worship Jesus? Christmas time, right? Of course, there are some other times where we see, obviously, where there may have been a worship of Jesus, but certainly we see at the incarnation, at his birth, they do. And so again, we see that. And then it jumps to a passage on verse 7 that looks a little bit strange. He makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire. Okay, what does that mean? Well, it's the idea that if you think about it, angels are compared to natural elements like wind and fire. Where does wind go? Well, in their day, they thought, well, wind goes where God directs it. Where does fire go? It's, you know, it's part of the natural world. So the implication here is that when God says go, the angels go. And so they are following the bidding of God the Father. And so in a sense, they're saying that they are like servants, very different than Jesus, who is the Son of God, if that is maybe helpful to you in that regard. You know, Pastor Graham has a book coming out on angels. I'm looking forward not only to reading the book, but getting him on my radio program to do an interview, because it will be a lot of fun to talk about that. And you learn a lot about angels throughout the Old and New Testament, but we learn a little bit about it even here in the book of Hebrews, because they're compared kind of to the natural elements. Whatever God says, they go and do. And so again, that's an illustration. But then we also see another aspect of that in verses 8 and 9. And here we see that Jesus is better because of his important role. And this is a quote from Psalm 45, verses 6 and 7. You might want to write that one down here. And we see in a very lengthy passage here in 8 and 9 a couple of things. First of all, we see that Jesus has a throne. And we see that Jesus is a ruler who sits on that throne. Number two, we see that his throne will last forever. It took a while to say, well, yeah, but don't angels last forever? And then I thought, oh, wait a minute, angels were created. Oh, okay. So, yes, they may exist from time on, but since they were created, Jesus was not, is the implication. So I figured that one out. And then finally, it says that Jesus loves righteousness. So again, Jesus is better because of his important role that he has, and we see that again in verses 8 and 9. Well, let's finish off the rest of chapter 1 here, and we now begin to see a couple of other things starting in verse 10. And you, Lord, laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will wear out like a garment. Like a robe, you will roll them up. Like a garment, they will be changed. But you are the same, and your years will have no end. And to which of the angels has he ever said, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool at your feet? Are they not all ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those who are to inherit salvation? And so again, we begin to see some very important issues here as well. By the way, by now, have you noticed how much larger the font is here? Another thing EJ suggested is maybe I need to increase the font. So can everybody see those now? Those are much larger than they were before. If you cannot see them, then I encourage you either to move forward or to look at them at your smartphone. Or else bring binoculars next time. I don't know. I don't think we can make them any larger, but we've made this much larger. So can you in the back see those? Because everybody told me to make the font larger. So there we are. Okay, we first of all see that this is the longest of the quotations, and this comes from Psalm 102. Isn't this amazing? I mean, we are seeing seven different quotations from the Old Testament in the first chapter of the book of Hebrews. Don't you wish you had that kind of understanding of the Old Testament or even the New Testament, as this writer obviously does? And the idea here is that the world that we see now is groaning in travail, as it says in Romans. The world we see now, although it looks nice and we look at all the beautiful landscape out here at the church and everything, but we recognize that the earth is running down. And there is going to be a time when God will, working through Jesus, change the created order. Put down 2 Peter 3, verses 11 to 13, one of the passages I'm going to look at in a couple of weeks when we introduce the Institute for Creation Research material, because here it says it's like a garment. I modernize it. It's like a coat. You ever had a coat? My wife every once in a while says, you know, that coat probably belongs at Salvation Army. But it feels so good, you know, but it's just kind of wearing out. You know what, you know, you guys, you know, you, we all have some t-shirts and shirts that our wives are ready to pitch, you know, and that's what this is, that the world is like a garment, like a coat, like an old suit that's wearing out. And there'll be a time when there'll be a new heaven and a new earth. Who will bring that about? Jesus. And so again, it's a reminder of that as well. So Jesus is better than creation. He's not only just better than the prophets, better than the angels, but he's better than creation because you know what? This world that we think is so permanent, it's going to cease to exist. There will be a new heaven and a new earth. So Jesus is better than creation itself. And then, of course, we see the seventh quotation here now from Psalm 110. We see this in verse 13 here. Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. And here it's the idea that Jesus has ascended and he's at the right hand. And we see that Jesus even claims this. This is one, again, of the claims of divinity. For those of you looking for other verses to share with your friends, neighbors, co-workers that deny the deity of Christ, here Jesus in Mark 12 quotes from this same psalm as an evidence of the fact of his divinity. So you see that. But then it ends by saying, make your enemies a footstool. Well, that has not happened, has it? The enemies are very strong right now. Friday morning, I spoke at Dallas Theological Seminary in Chapel on ISIS, and we had quite a discussion there about that. And then, of course, we've been talking about the refugees and all the other issues, and we recognize that there are certainly great enemies out there. But not just enemies that carry weapons. They're enemies to the gospel. They're enemies to the belief in the deity of Christ. They're enemies to those who deny the authority of God's word and on and on. But there someday will be a day when those enemies that seem so strong before us right now, they will be nothing more than a footstool at the feet of Jesus. And that's really a great claim, especially as this was being written to, no doubt, Jewish believers who had become Christians, who may have been estranged from their family, may have been persecuted, may have been at this point going through the Neronian persecution, may have found that they were beginning to have serious doubts about their faith, all sorts of things to recognize. There will be a day when what you see right now, the enemies, whether it's the Gnostics, whether it's the Romans, whether it's the Jewish Pharisees, whether it's the pagans or whatever it might be, that they will be nothing more than a footstool at the feet of Jesus. And then we see that also in verse 14, one last interesting comment, and that is, are they not ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those who inherit salvation? And here, once again, reminds us that angels have a servant role. The word angelos, from which we get the word angels, means what? Messenger. And they are messengers, and they have a different kind of authority than God's Son has an authority. If you'd like to look at this, maybe as soon as Pastor Graham's book comes out on angels, we'll go and do a series on his book on angels. Wouldn't it be nice if we could bring him in here and ask him a question or two? I don't know if that could ever work out. It'd be fun to do that. But again, in the Old Testament, we see that angels deliver believers. We see this in Psalm 34. So angels do have a very important role in delivering believers in the Old Testament. There are also angelic rescues in the New Testament. One of those is Acts 12. And Pastor Graham today even referred to Paul singing and the earthquake, in this case, opening it up. But we see some examples of the ministry of angels. So as important as angels are, as important as the creation is, as important prophets were, Jesus is what? Jesus is better. And that's, I think, the argument that we want to make today. Chapter 1 is pretty simple. Jesus is better. Three words. But more than that, it's also a reminder that Jesus has won the victory. He sits at the right hand before the Father. He holds the world together. And if you wonder if the world is falling apart, in some ways it is. That's acknowledged even in this chapter. But we know who holds it together and keeps it from completely falling apart. And we know and look forward to a time when he returns and there will be a new heaven and a new earth. In the time we're remaining, especially since I've been joined by some of you that have been singing in the choir today, thank you again for your service, I wanted to spend a little bit of time answering this question about the decline of a nation. Last week we talked about the harbinger, and we talked about the Shemitah, and a lot of people said, well, are we in the midst of perilous times? You know, probably. I would believe that whether I read any of those books. But what about this? Because there have been a lot of people over the centuries that have looked at how nations rise and nations fall. And so I thought for just a few minutes, I'm going to turn this into a history class. You don't mind that, do you? And give you a real quick look at what various historians, some very secular historians, other Christian historians have said about the whole cycle of nations. First of all, a couple of key quotes. George Santayana said, "Those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it." Probably you've heard that phrase before. Those who have not learned from history certainly are destined to repeat it. George Hegel, "What experience in history teaches is this, that people and government never have learned anything from history or acted upon principles deduced from it." So maybe we can learn from history, even if some have not. One of the things I have on the handout here is what's called the cycle of nations. And this is developed many years ago. It's been attributed to a man by the name of Alexander Teitler. Well, it turns out that if you go and look at the writings of Alexander Teitler, who was about an 18th century historian, nobody can find it there. So whether this was taken from maybe one of his messages, or maybe somebody got it confused, we don't know. And I still think it's very helpful to think about the rise and fall of a nation, but I don't think we can actually attribute it to him, which is okay. You know, there are a lot of quotes that get attributed, I think, inaccurately to individuals. I've ever heard Blaise Pascal supposedly said there's a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every man. There's no evidence that Pascal ever said that. But it doesn't matter. Isn't there a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of individuals? Of course there is. And we can go to the Ecclesiastes where it says God has placed eternity in the heart of every individual. So this is the same kind of thing. I think we know who may have actually written this based upon the writings of Alexander Teitler, but it doesn't matter. Individuals that have looked at various nations, whether you look at Greece or Rome, whether you look at the Carthaginians or the Etruscans, whether you look at the Egyptians, the Babylonians, or even the nation of Israel, you see something very interesting. That is, oftentimes a nation is born in the midst of some kind of spiritual faith. They're in bondage, but eventually, because of some kind of revival, the nation begins. Even in our country, you see the great First Great Awakening preceded what? The American Revolution. Well, that spiritual faith leads to great courage because now they're willing to fight and even sometimes willing to die for something because they believe in something more than just their day-to-day activity. And that great courage leads to liberty. And now that republic begins to enjoy the freedom that it never had before. And because of that great political and sometimes economic liberty, there is great abundance. Because as the engines of commerce begin to cycle, this begins to be the great golden age of a republic. But sadly, in its success are sown the very seeds of its failure, because the next generation, taking for granted that abundance, they become what? Selfish. And later they become complacent and even apathetic because they no longer had to fight those battles, but now they enjoy the fruits of what the previous generation gave to them. But now they take that for granted, and they're no longer willing to fight for liberty and fight against the barbarians at the gate. And so as a result, that apathy leads to moral decay and dependence and oftentimes back to bondage. Does that sound familiar? I think some of you right now are saying, okay, there's 10 cycles. Where are we in those 10? I'll let you figure out where we are. Now, does that mean that's always destined? No, it doesn't, because there have been times when revivals have revitalized a nation. This week I had Eric Metaxas on my radio program. He has a new book out on seven women. We talked about Susanna Wesley. We spent some time talking about the Wesleyan Revival. The Wesleyan Revival and William Wilberforce turned the direction of England dramatically in a way that I think was striking in terms of a nation that was headed downhill, but led to Victorian England and led to its rise. We had a second great awakening in our 19th century that I think turned the direction. Do we have any biblical examples? How about Nineveh and Jonah? So it doesn't mean that you're always destined to destruction and towards back to bondage, but if something doesn't happen, eventually that's kind of what plays out. They found that the average lifespan of most of these civilizations was about 200 years. Now, the Carthaginians and Etruscans were smaller. Of course, Rome and Greece were larger, and Great Britain is larger. But you can see that 200 years tends to be kind of a middle-aged civilization. And that's kind of what we find. Here's some key quotes. I know this one's kind of small, but I just wanted to try to get it on two pages here. Malcolm Muggeridge put it this way. He said, "I can conclude that civilizations, like every other human creation, wax and wane. By the nature of the case, there can never be a lasting civilization any more than there can be a lasting spring or a lasting happiness in an individual's life or a lasting stability in our society." In other words, he says, you know, nations rise and nations fall. They don't always stay the way they were. He says, it's the nature of man and of all that he constructs to perish, and it must ever be so. The world is full of the debris of past civilizations, and others are known to have existed which have not left any debris behind them, but have just disappeared. He goes on to say, whatever their ideology may be, from the Garden of Eden onward, such dreams of lasting felicity have cropped up and no doubt always will. But the realization is impossible for the simple reason that a fallen creature like man, though capable of conceiving perfection and aspiring after it, is in himself and his works forever imperfect. Thus he is fated to exist in the no man's land between the perfection he can conceive and the imperfection that characterizes his own nature and everything that he does. Relates a little bit to Hebrews. Even the creation will pass away. Nations will pass away. God's not destined to keep the United States of America going forever, or any other nation, for that matter. Let's talk about this. If you notice in the handout there, moral decay. There was a man by the name of Edward Gibbon in the 18th century that wrote a book called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Now, he's a very secular mindset, but he was looking at what caused the Roman Empire to fall. And his argument is that eventually the Roman Empire gave into the vices of strangers. They found that morals collapsed. The laws became oppressive. And the abuse of power became such that the nation was eventually vulnerable to the barbarians. His argument is that Rome fell from within long before the barbarians at the gate took them over. Is that kind of interesting? The moral decay sometimes is the reason for the destruction or the decline of a nation. A Christian book that has come out over the last couple of years by Jim Nelson Black. He's co-authored various books with D. James Kennedy and others. He actually, in his book, talks about 10 warning signs which he found in other nations that seem to apply to our nation as well. And maybe sometime, if we have some time in the future, I'll cover that in more detail. But one of the people he quotes in his book is a British historian, Catherine Edwards, that demonstrated, interestingly enough, the examples that we find of immorality in Greece and in Rome and in Egypt and Babylon and others, we find examples of that in the Western world today. For example, she found that lots of times they tried to practice contraception. Now, of course, we have much more effective contraception than they had in their day. But then the birth rate began to drop. We're going to talk about that more in just a minute. Abortion is not something that was developed in the 19th and 20th century. Abortions existed even in the first century. Some people say, well, abortion's not in the Bible. True, but if you look at the teaching of the 12, which is one of the early documents by the early church fathers, they actually spoke out against abortion in that day, even in the Roman Empire. And then, of course, oftentimes in the Rome, a father had complete control over his family. And if a child were born and he did not want that child, he would just simply leave it out on the street. And it would die of exposure. Except the Christians began to see that, so they would go out and they would rescue those children and make them part of their own. Which is one of the reasons why I think Christianity exploded, because they had never seen anything like this before. And so again, she says, we see this in Rome. We see this in other cultures. We see, unfortunately, too much of this in the UK and the United States as well. Here's a good example of what he found. Life became cheap in the latter days of the Roman Empire. There were burdensome regulations and taxes and ultimately made manufacturing and trade unprofitable. Well, surely that's not happening here in the United States, right? Families were locked into hereditary trades and vocations, allowing little vocational choice. And so as a result, people were very frustrated because there was nothing they could do to support their families. Eventually, children were seen as needless burdens. Abortion and infanticide became commonplace. And in some cases, they would actually take their children and sell them into slavery. We see some things of that nature, don't we? Seen any of those videos from Planned Parenthood lately? And it just remind us of how that has been the case. In Greece, they found that the music of the young people became wild and coarse. Popular entertainment was brutal and vulgar. You go to these amphitheaters. We're going to do a tour of Greece next year, and we'll go into one or two of these amphitheaters. Originally, this was where the great plays were done, but eventually they got more and more debased and debauched. Then promiscuity, homosexuality, and drunkenness began part of the daily life there in Greece. And all sorts of moral and social restraints were lost, leading to greater decadence. That's Greece. That sounded a little bit like our country. And then I thought we might spend a little bit of time, before we run out of time here, on the decline of a family. A very good book written a number of years ago by Carl Wilson, Our Dance Has Turned to Death. I want to take the middle sections where he talks about the decline of the family. But his argument is very simple, and it's an argument that is made by Michael Novak. Michael Novak said, you know, as families go, so goes the nation. If the family does not do well, the nation falls apart. He won the Templeton Award for that essay that he gave on that. But nevertheless, Carl Wilson, also a Christian, used to be the head of actually the high school ministry of Campus Crusade for Christ, now called CRU, went through in his book and documented a number of people. J.D. Unwin, who was a British historian, Pitram Sorokin, who was a sociologist, and they found some of the trends of what happens when a nation falls apart. And almost all of them documented that when the family falls apart, the nation falls apart. Because if you think about it, the family is the unit of the nation, is it not? And so let's, if we can, look at the stages that he found as they looked primarily at Greece and Rome. And the first stage is that they found that after a period of time, men, as they were in decline, no longer led their families in worship. As a result, spiritual and moral development kind of became secondary. They weren't the foundation of the home. Their view of God became naturalistic, mathematical, and mechanical. Especially saw that in Greece. The second stage is where the men then neglected care for their wives and children so that they could go off and pursue material wealth, political, and military power. And so material values began to dominate, and they began to exalt in their role as individuals. Well, this led to the obvious third stage, and that is a reaction, because after a while they changed their values. Well, the women reacted to that as well. They were preoccupied with business or with war. They neglected their wives sexually, got involved in lower class women, homosexuality began to spring up, and the women began to assert themselves as well, because in the fourth stage, the role of women at home and with their children lost value and status. No longer raising children was a benefit. No longer was it seen as something that was helpful. And so women were neglected and their roles were devalued. And the birth rates began to drop. And you began to have difficulties there. And we saw that in the Carthaginians. And we saw that in Greece and others, where they weren't maintaining their population. Then they began to compete with each other for money, for home leadership, for the affection of their children. And then many of these marriages ended in separation or divorce. Divorce was very easy in some of these pagan cultures, and is even to this day is easy in the Muslim culture. You simply say, I divorce you, and that's it. I mean, there's not even a legal requirement there. It's enough to simply say that is the end of it. The sixth stage, selfish individualism grew and carried over into society. It fragmented into smaller and smaller group loyalties, what sometimes people call the Balkanization of a nation, where you have groups that no longer assimilated, but they are actually separated. They're balkanized, and you have separate group loyalties, and everybody is sort of fighting with one another, and there is no kind of national unity. And then the decrease in the birth rate produced an older population that had less ability to defend itself. Many people argue that Carthage fell in large part because they simply just did not have enough individuals to fight the barbarians, and they had hired mercenaries who had no loyalty to the country whatsoever. Some of that, perhaps, you could tie to the latter parts of Greece, of course, many years after Alexander the Great. But you can see how those trends have really played out when we look at this society. Then, fifth stage, unbelief in God became more and more complete, and parental authority diminished, and ethical and moral principles disappeared, affecting both the economy and the government. And although I say this was a pattern for things like Greece and Rome, I think it's relevant today, because what you see is that the families are the foundation of a nation. And when the family crumbles, the nation falls apart, because nations are built upon those family units. So you have to ask yourself the question, where are we in this process? And how do we find ourselves back? If you're not ready for a spiritual revival, I don't know what. You know, if this does not light your fire, your wood is wet. I mean, this is one reason why we have to recognize that really the answer to the problems in America are found right here in this church at Prestonwood Baptist Church. Would you not agree? I mean, this is why we have to recognize what we are facing as a country as well. There have been some that have even looked at this from a secular point of view. And I thought I'd throw this in real quickly. Cullen Murphy, let's put it honestly, is not a Christian by any stretch of the imagination. He's kind of a liberal progressive. He wrote this book in part to show the remarkable similarities between Rome and the United States. He wrote that when George Bush was president. Being a liberal progressive, he wanted to say, you know, we're on the same path because this horrible president, George W. Bush, is creating this. You get the sense that that was kind of his idea. Well, I actually turned it into a week of radio programs, but I did after President Bush was no longer president and President Obama was president, to point out that in some respects, a lot of this has nothing to do with who the president is. If anything, the second president, I think, did some things the first president did not. But the point of it is that there are some striking similarities between Rome and America. For example, the Roman Empire, about the same period of time when they had their dominance, had about the same landmass as the lower 48 states, the contiguous United States. They were politically dominant in the world. Today, we are still the only major superpower. We are politically dominant as well. Global influence in terms of trade. So there are some real similarities. Now, there's some striking differences because we are a modern technological society. That was primarily an agricultural society still. We have a democracy, a republic, and that was a brutal kind of form of government. Slavery was there, but, you know, let's recognize slavery was part of our ancient past here in America. Entrepreneurship was really frowned upon in Rome, whereas it's generally extolled here. But nevertheless, you see incredible parallels as well. And you've seen us already talk about some of those. A massive government structure, a massive regulatory structure, maybe a little bit too much self-pride, a sense that we're the only players in the world and those kinds of things. And so, again, it's just a reminder that humility and maybe understanding some of the things that led to the decline of other nations could be leading to the decline of this nation as well. And so again, we can see that. But turn with me, if you might. We've got a few minutes left. I wasn't sure we'd have time to do this, but I think we will. Turn with me to Romans 1 real quickly, and we'll see one last evidence of spiritual decline. We've talked about moral decline. We've talked about political decline. We've talked about family decline. But in Romans 1, we see in verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress their truth. And then goes on to begin to talk about the fact that here God has revealed himself so they were without excuse. Although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking. Their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. And then we now see that God gave them over to the lust of their hearts. And four different times we see this. And in Romans 1, we see Paul looking at the Roman Empire, seeing its decline, and he gives us a set of stages as well. Because the first stage is where the people turn from God to idolatry. Although God has revealed himself in nature, and we are without excuse, it says in Romans 1, nevertheless, they chose to worship the creation rather than the Creator. So that's stage number one. They turn from God to idolatry. And in this result, they have a general lack of thankfulness, and they're ungrateful for the fact that God has prospered them. They no longer honor God because their foolish heart becomes darkened, and professing to be wise, they have become fools. Well, the second stage is when now we see this starting in verse 24. That's where men and women exchange their natural use of sex for unnatural uses. And here we see these four sobering words. God gave them over. You know, in a society with lust-driven sensuality and sexual perversion, God gives them over to their passions and their unnatural desires. So the third stage is obvious. If God no longer is in control and God gives them over, sounds a little bit like what we talked about last week in terms of the harbinger. You know, God just simply says, that's it. I'll let you do your thing. Once society has rejected God's revelation, it's on its own. and moral and social anarchy are just the natural result. If you reject God's view, if you reject God's authority, if you reject God's commandments, and you try to run it on your own, anarchy is going to be the case. At this point, God has given it over to sinners who have a depraved mind, do what is evil. And so then the final one is simply judgment. God's judgment falls upon those. And whether that judgment comes in that generation or the next, certainly we see that. And certainly there's an eternal judgment that awaits those who are guilty, but I think there's also a social judgment. When you reject the owner's manual, when you no longer follow the instructions, it's not going to work out very well. And as a society, we have done so. As Parker said, I hate to be so sober, but some of you ask, what can we learn from other nations? And I think what we can learn is that God still can use us as Christians here in America. I think God can still use America as a mission-sending organization and as a mission-sending nation. We certainly have sent missionaries around the world. But God does not need the United States of America either. And if we continue to turn our back on him, you get the sense, very sobering, that God gave them over and God will turn his back on us. Something to think about. Just before we're done, I wanted to mention that this Wednesday I have Max Lucado in studio on his new book, Glory Days. So if any of you would like to come, of course he's been here at Prestonwood before, but if you'd like to actually meet him and be part of the interview, feel free to drop by. Now, I can give you directions to that. It will be at 1 p.m. at kind of Midway and Alpha is where the studio is, and it's on Wednesday. And if you'd like to meet Max Lucado, just a very nice individual, I know he'd love to shake hands with you and chat with you, and you can watch part or all of the interview, and it would just be a great opportunity for you to be a part of that. So if I don't see you on Wednesday, I'll see you next Sunday. Parker?